Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. My voice gets deeper by the week.
Deeper by the week. Wow, that was interesting.
I know. Thank you. You know, just living the healthy lifestyle over here. a couple weeks ago, I was feeling great, and now I'm crashing again. So. But, you know, it is what it is. How are you doing?
I'm good. I feel like I say that all the time. I'm good.
I'm good. I'm great. Yeah. You know those people when you're like, hey, how are you? How's your day? And they're like, it's not great. This morning, my cat, like, scratched my leg, and then that made me late for work, and now I'm here, and then I spilled my coffee on the way to work, and you're just like, okay.
Well, you asked.
I know, it's true. But people are asking to be nice, you know?
Yeah. But I do that, too. Really, like, when someone asks how I am, I like to try to not just say I'm good. Like, I want to follow it up with something. But I
give a real
definitely am not going to, like, not draw it out. Yeah.
Well, Lena, question. Mm. Have you ever seen a house on fire?
Like, I have.
You have?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
So, just a couple years ago, a block around, so I heard or saw the flashing lights from the fire trucks and heard the sirens, and it's like in the middle of the night, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my.
And I walked outside, and I can see across the street, the house behind that house was just flames going up. So I walked around the block at 2 o'clock in the morning while Chris was asleep.
Oh, Lena.
What a dodo. But yeah, I walked around, and like several other neighbors were out there, and the flames were just hauling.
Oh my gosh. I've also seen a house on fire, and it was so scary. When I lived in Florida, I was headed out to dinner to meet up with some friends, and I don't remember what time it was, but it was dark. And as I drove down this long road, I saw like a flickering up ahead, like really far ahead in the distance on the left. And at first I was like, what is that? Because it was a neighborhood, like up on the left. And as I got closer, I saw that this house was on fire, like engulfed, the whole back of the house. And it backed up to like this brick wall that lined the road.
Oh,
so it was completely engulfed in flames. The roof was on fire. So I pulled over and called 911 because there was nobody around. Wow. There was like a car that was pulled over on that side of the road by the house, and I was on the other side going the opposite direction. But I didn't see anyone in the car. There was nobody outside the car, so I just immediately called 911. But I just stood there like frozen because I just felt helpless. I was scared. I was worried that the other homes next to it would be affected because, you know, those houses are so close together.
Yeah.
In like the newer subdivisions these days. And anyway, it didn't take long for the firefighters to get there. But once they got there, I just still stood there. Like, I didn't know what to do. Yeah, exactly. And I don't know those people. I didn't know them. But what if you did know somebody who had been affected by a fire? Like, the horror of seeing someone's home on fire.
It's so sad.
It is. That's precisely the thing that affected a bedroom community on March 7th, 2011, in a small town called Teaneck, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan. Now, officers received a call around 12:15 a.m. that a house was on fire at 212 Elm Street. When they got there, neighbors and passersby had gathered in crowds just watching. You know, they're watching the house burn. They didn't know what to do. And, you know, we as lay people don't think of running in. You know, firefighters run in. Just stand there and go, my God, you know, just there's nothing you can do.
Yeah. It takes a special person to be a firefighter.
Exactly. It really does. So while officers started taping off the scene and escorting onlookers back behind the yellow tape, firefighters rushed in. They started fighting the blaze that had engulfed the entire house. And once they got the fire out, they made entry into the home to look for anyone who might have been inside. They cleared the first and the second floor. And one strategy they had in this case, and I'm sure many others, is that they follow the burn patterns, right? So the areas with the least amount of smoke and fire damage obviously were the most recently affected areas. So the further you work your way in, the darker and darker the home becomes until you find the blackest part, which is likely the origin of the fire. So they're working their way through the home, following these burn patterns, also searching for any survivors while taking everything in. And they found that the fire had started down in the basement. Actually, it was a bedroom down in the basement, specifically on the bed. And on that bed was a severely burned body.
No.
And they must have thought for a second that the person could be saved because they scooped him up and took them out to the backyard. They laid them on the ground and tried to resuscitate them, but they quickly realized the person was dead.
Wow.
Every inch of their body was charred and they were motionless. I mean, it was obvious. So once they realized there was nothing that they could do for this victim, they went back into the basement to see where, if there was anybody else in the home. And after finding no one else, this is when the real investigation begins. Investigators on scene began asking onlookers, like, who lives here? Like, whose home is this? Do you know? Seems like a perfect way to start. I mean, you've got neighbors and people in the area that are putting themselves at the scene.
Right.
You know, in droves. And if they're standing there watching, chances are they're going to start talking.
Oh, yeah. So
they could potentially get some good information here. And they were about to get a name, the name of the homeowner. His name was Robert Cantor. A neighbor told the first responders that he lived alone. Now, Rob Cantor was 59 years old and by all accounts, just a stand-up individual. It's always the good ones, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was a software engineer. He was devoted to his two daughters. He loved to travel, particularly loved to ski and kayak. He loved to cook and pair wines with foods, which I think just speaks to like his detailed oriented side. I love when people take the time to pair wine with food.
Enjoy the little things.
Exactly. It's the little things. Now, he and his wife raised their little family in Teaneck, New Jersey, which was a great place to raise a family. They were very involved in their community, close with their neighbors. But Robert had recently separated from his wife. And, you know, it's sad to me, but their girls had gotten older. Rob and his wife had just, I guess they realized that, you know, for so many years they were devoted to their children. They kind of lost sight of their marriage all those years. And in the process, they sort of grew into two different people along the way. But You know, luckily it was a very amicable separation because while they had been legally separated for a year, she'd still been living there at the home. And she didn't move out until about 5 months before the fire happened.
Oh.
So they were in the process of legally divorcing, but they remained very good friends, which I guess is about as great as you can ask for.
Right.
In a divorce situation. Well, let's go back to the fire. The damage to the home was extensive. Arson investigators were on the scene scouring the residence for clues as to the origin of the fire, any physical evidence that they could salvage. The damage to the home, they said, indicated a temperature of upward of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
I can't even wrap my mind around that.
No way. I mean, 110 degrees in Texas is...
Oh. I mean, 2,000 degrees. Anything left behind at the scene was just cooked, you know?
Right.
The beams and the joists were exposed, so the walls and the ceiling had just, like, melted away, especially down in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
The bed where Rob had been laying was burned down to the springs, and that was about all that remained of the bed, except there was something on the bed.
Oh.
Under where Rob's body was, there was a small remnant of comforter.
Oh.
His body must have protected that bit of cloth,
like
that little piece of cloth, from completely burning up in the blaze. So they collected that potential piece of evidence and kept moving through the basement to see, you know, what could have started the fire. Rob was not a smoker. There were no matches, lighters, candles, anything of that nature that could account for this being an accident. And spoiler, if this was an accident, I bet we wouldn't be here talking about this case right now.
Right. You've got a point.
They sent their little scrap of bedding to the lab, and a preliminary test revealed that there was ethanol on the comforter.
Oh.
Why would ethanol be on somebody's comforter?
Interesting.
Well, it wouldn't.
Mm-mm.
So they gleaned that this was intentional, and Rob himself was likely the origin of the fire.
Oh. It's terrible.
Now, at Rob's autopsy, they took an x-ray of the body before they do anything else. And this is typical of autopsies in general, you know, before they start inspecting, dissecting. Well, that x-ray revealed something pretty horrifying. There were bullet fragments in Rob's head.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it looked like a single 380 caliber shot had entered the back of his head at close range. There was stippling and soot, and the medical examiner determined that the gun would have been maybe an inch from his head at most.
Oh, wow.
So, back to the scene they go, because now they know they're looking for a murder weapon.
Yeah.
And any other forensic pieces of the puzzle they can connect together at this point. I can't imagine how difficult...
Mm-mm.
It is to dig around a burnt crime scene looking for something specific.
Yeah.
When everything's like black and just crumbling.
Right. But thank God there's experts.
So careful. Oh, I know. I mean, you don't want to step on something or further bury something,
right.
Like turn something over on top of something important. So.
Oh, man.
They were very gentle. They lifted every layer piece by piece, and under the bed where Rob had been sleeping, they found a shell casing that looked to be a 380. And that matched the bullet fragments that were found in Rob's head.
Well.
So Jimmy crack corn.
Mm-hmm.
They gathered that Rob must have been shot right there on the bed because, you know, there was the casing, there was Rob's body. So in just days, police had put together a lot of information. They had how he died, you know, he was set on fire. But who would have done this? I mean, they were interviewing family and friends. Nobody could think of anybody who would want him dead. Well, they were particularly interested in speaking with his ex-wife. And
obviously,
she was a wreck. She was a wreck. They had been together 34 years. And they still loved each other very much. They remained really close friends.
Oh, no.
And that just says something for the amount of love that they had for each other. She gave them the name of a woman, though, that Rob had been seeing. She's like, her name's Sophie something, but she didn't really know much about her. She didn't know her last name. And she just said, yeah, they're seeing each other. Like, I don't really know much more about that. Well, they'll need to talk to her.
Yeah.
Right? But first, did anyone else see anything, hear anything that night that could help them tie up loose ends or, you know, establish some sort of a timeline? Well, one neighbor on Rob Street said that she heard a loud bang around 11:45, and she remembered specifically because she was sitting in her living room. She remembered the exact time, and remember that 911 call came in about 12:15.
Right, yeah.
So, just 30 minutes later. So, they believe that that was the time he was shot. Well, they went over to New York City to meet up with this Sophie. And she, too, was devastated, just falling apart.
Wow.
She had actually already learned of Rob's death through friends.
Oh.
But Sophie did not know he was murdered.
Oh.
She just thought he died in a fire. She had no idea. So when police revealed that to her, she was just beside herself with grief.
Oh, my gosh.
Sophie was from France. She had moved to the U.S. in 1991 to pursue higher education. She got her master's and worked her way up in the corporate world and eventually settled into finance in New York. Sophie met Rob in 2009 at a seminar at the National Academy of Science. She was beautiful, and I'm sure that was an initial spark for him, but he was drawn to a lot of other things about her, too. She was a runner, and they sort of bonded over that and their enjoyment of an active lifestyle, you know, outdoorsy people.
Yeah.
They became friends there. They started keeping in touch, but soon it turned into something more. And Rob's sister said of him that, you know, she was so happy for him. He wasn't the sort of person that needed a woman on his arm. You know, he wasn't looking for love after his divorce or anything. He didn't put himself out there. So she knew there must have been something special between them because it was just organically happened, you know?
Yeah.
Ugh, I hate this.
Mm.
There was just one problem with this new budding romance. Sophie was married.
Oh my gosh.
She was married with 3 kids.
Girl.
Yes. Her husband, Cam Tony Tung, he went by Tony. He was a loaf. I don't know. He worked on computers at home. He built them for people. He took them apart. He, you know, salvaged parts and sold things he could, etc. And Sophie was the breadwinner. You know, she made the money. She was in finance. And she actually even gave Tony around 10 grand to start up an actual business doing this computer stuff, like building it for people and whatever.
Right.
So he was basically a tinker and whatever hopes he had for making this an actual business, he didn't do so great. And, you know, tensions really emerged in their relationship because he was not pulling his weight, you know? There's nothing less attractive than coming home and finding your husband taking apart computers and doing whatever else. Like, what else? I'm sure he wasn't cleaning the kitchen, you know? So it was very easy for her to take the step out the door of her marriage. You know, she was, things were already really bad. I'm not saying, I'm not excusing her behavior, but I'm, you know, things were already, she was already there. She was already at the door. She had her hand on the doorknob, basically. Mm-hmm. And when she met Rob, it was, you know, that friendship, she just really
He had the spark that she was missing. Yeah,
exactly. And he was so a go-getter. You know, Rob was completely different. He was very successful. So it was very easy for her to fall into that. Well, on Valentine's Day, Sophie walked into her house to find a card there from her husband. Isn't that sweet? He took a break from his computers to go get her a card. Well, when she opened it up, the verbiage of the card struck her.
Uh-oh.
It was like pretty much word for word something she'd emailed to Rob
days before.
Yeah. So her heart sank.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked up at her husband and he confronted her right there. He confronted her about the affair. He's like, why are you emailing a man? Like, what is all of this about? And she's like, well, how are you reading my emails? Is the question. He said that an anonymous sender sent him a notebook of all these printed emails between her and Rob. He said he didn't know where they came from, but they're probably from the mafia because Tony alleged that Rob had mafia ties.
Okay.
Spoiler, that is not true in the slightest.
Oh my God.
So Tony, he starts to become really unhinged at this point. Like, he bought a gun saying that he needed to keep his family safe from this mafia entanglement that Sophie had gotten them into. And Sophie was not happy about that. She's like, you better get that gun out of my house. I don't want it around the children. Like, no. Tony also showed up at Rob's home out of the blue. And he demanded to see where he had had sex with his wife.
Oh my gosh. So did Rob know that she was married?
You know, I couldn't find that information. At some point he knew because Tony arrived
at
his home.
At this time,
I don't know if he knew prior, like if he had known that whole time that she was married.
Right.
I don't know that Sophie would have kept that from him. I don't think so. Mm. I don't see, she doesn't seem like that type of person to have kept that from him. I think she probably told him the truth, like, things are really bad in my marriage, blah, 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 blah. But he did eventually know for sure because of these visits. And it wasn't just once.
Oh, goodness.
A little bit much, right? Show me where you had sex with my wife. Like, I want to see the inside of your home right now.
Wow.
Well, Rob was like, oh, just in here on the bed.
Here you go.
He wasn't being nasty. Rob was just one of those level-headed, rational guys, and he thought, if I just show him, like, if I just answer the poor guy's question, he'll leave, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
He wasn't afraid of Tony or anything. Like, he didn't feel afraid. He was like, this is, you know, the guy's hurt. Yeah. I'm just gonna show him the bed. So, Tony, I said he didn't just confront him once. He had confronted him at least on three separate occasions.
Mm-mm.
And was like, back off, man. That's my wife. Like, you're ruining our family. And Rob was like, you know, look, that's up to her. I mean, if she's not happy and wants out of the marriage, that's her decision. I can't make that decision for her. This is really up to her.
Mm.
And really, I mean, Sophie was going to Rob. It wasn't like he kidnapped her, you know.
True.
But as a scorned husband, I can understand his frustration and anger for sure.
Right, yeah.
So when investigators brought Tony in for questioning, because none of this looks good for him, you know, they asked him about the emails and the gun, and he said, oh, I've had that gun for 10 years. Like, I didn't just buy that. But they said, Sophie said you just got a gun, like, not too long ago, a couple weeks ago. He said, oh, that gun. Well, that's actually a friend's gun, and I gave it back.
Oh, okay, good.
But he said it was a 9mm, and he said he never owned a 380. Okay. Well, they asked what he was doing the night that Rob died. He said he picked up two of his daughters from Sophie's place to take them to dinner, and that actually was verified through CCTV footage from her apartment building. He can be seen talking to the two little girls in the lobby. And investigators said, what are you guys talking about? Because, like, they're just standing there in the lobby talking. They're not going anywhere or doing anything. And he said, oh, right there, that's when my daughter had just informed me that she met mommy's friend Rob that day.
Oh, no.
So you see him take them back to Sophie's apartment.
Oh.
Yeah. He drove home, arriving around 9 p.m. He said he had nothing to do with Rob's murder.
Right.
Absolutely not. He said, yeah, I was pissed that Rob was seeing my wife, but I was in Manhattan all night that night. So he said he'd been drinking some beers at home. He cleaned the kitchen. He answered some emails. He read a book.
Hmm.
The guy's doing some stuff, you know?
How wholesome.
I know, right? He said, I only left my house to go get more beers. And that was around 1 a.m. Well, investigators thought, I don't know about all this. He's got to be our guy. He's the only person that would have motive to kill Rob. Nobody else
sounds like it. Yeah.
Wants this. And Sophie had actually filed for divorce May 3rd, which was just 3 days before the murder. You know, she was done with her marriage, and she was all in with Rob. That much was clear.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe that when Tony's daughter told him about being introduced to Rob that day, that was it. That set Tony off.
Right.
So that was the last straw for him, his wife, and now his kids. To Tony, Rob was taking his entire family away. But they had no evidence to tie him to Rob's murder. They couldn't hold him. I can't imagine how difficult it must be for an investigator to know that you have the right guy in the seat and to know in your gut, but you have to let them walk out that door.
Yeah.
You know? Like, ugh. So.
Heart-wrenching.
They had easily verified Tony's movements through CCTV. You know, he picked up his daughters like he said he did, at the time he said he did. So now they want to know what he did after that. New York City.
Mm.
The city that does not sleep. The city that does not blink. You know, it's littered with cameras every corner.
Yeah.
So they had him leaving Sophie's apartment at 8:20 p.m. And then they see him park his car at 10:10, just down the street from his apartment. And he can be seen exiting his vehicle and walking towards his apartment from there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that he told police that he went straight home from Sophie's. Well, he lived 30 minutes from her. So 8:20 to 10:10, where'd he go?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a camera near his apartment caught him leaving his place again around 10:40. And he had something in his hand, a white plastic bag. It's always a white plastic bag.
What is it? What is it with these white
plastic? Why do they have a white plastic bag? Like, not a duffel bag or something, you know, like one of those. Yeah, exactly. Well, he walked to his car and you know, that he had parked earlier on.
Uh-huh.
And he got in and he just sat there for several minutes.
Contemplating.
Right. Well, then he gets out of his car.
Nope.
Still with the white bag. And he starts walking down the street in the opposite direction, like away from his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last they could physically place Tony near his home. So they get search warrants for his apartment, his computer business, all his electronics and personal items. They found that he had installed a program on Sophie's laptop that would log her activity and keystrokes.
Wow.
And that's how he got her login information and was able to get her emails. They found a whole folder on Rob. Phone numbers, his friends' information, physical. And he had taken a photo from Rob's home on one of those visits that he had had at Rob's home. He took a photo of him and his dog or something off of the refrigerator. Like, okay.
Yeah.
And Tony had a program on his laptop called CCleaner that would basically allow you to pretty much do everything in ghost mode. Like, it would delete things, delete your history or your cache as you were doing it. It would destroy files, searches, etc. And he'd been running that program on his computer the night of Rob's murder.
Mm-hmm.
So, he was indicted. He was arrested for Rob's murder because they had a lot of circumstantial evidence. They may not have had any, like, physical evidence or forensic evidence, but they had enough. Tony Tung went to trial in December of 2015. He had a public defender because, well, his meal ticket, his wife was not going to be paying for that defense attorney. And computer forensics were very useful in this case. An expert testified that there was pretty much crickets on Tony's computer after about 9:45, and it didn't resume until 1:11 a.m. So,
interesting.
All that returning of emails talk was malarkey.
Uh-huh.
Then, if that's not enough for you to furrow your brow, he permanently deleted a bunch of files at 2 a.m. So, what are you doing, Tony? Well, prosecutors told the jury that Tony was the only person on this planet that could have wanted Rob dead. They alleged that Tony had been planning to take revenge on Rob for some time. And that night, like I said, Daddy, we met Mommy's friend Rob.
Mm-hmm.
He just snapped, and that was it. He went home, he got the gun and ethanol to set the fire, and he set off for Rob's house. Once he got to Rob's, he knocked on the door. Rob answered. He forced his way in at gunpoint, took him down to the basement, where he shot Rob in the very place that he had made love to his wife.
Oh my gosh.
She was shot in the back of the head and then set on fire. With everything taken together, the jury agreed with the state. And in 2016, Tony was found guilty of Rob's murder, arson, stalking, desecration of remains, destroying evidence, and some weapons charges. And on February 26th, he was sentenced to life in prison with an additional 10 years for burning a body and destroying evidence.
Wow.
He appealed, like most of them do, you know?
Yeah.
And that would be the end of the story if his conviction wasn't overturned.
What?
The appellate panel of judges said, hang on.
Oh, my Lord.
Tony has a point here. Tony had asked for an attorney while he was being questioned, but they kept talking to him. Additionally, there was some inadmissible testimony from a detective in Bergen County, but I couldn't locate what specifically that testimony entailed or why it was inadmissible, but the main thing was that he asked for an attorney. So his rights were violated. Uh-huh. So anything he said couldn't be used, but it was used.
Okay.
And the judges agreed that through technicalities, his rights under the law were not maintained at the time of the line of questioning, and the conviction was overturned in 2019.
Girl.
Tony was released from prison, and he is a free man while he awaits another trial. What?
I'm speechless. Yeah,
I don't know. Even. Now, I can see a conviction being overturned on technicalities, no matter how unfair it seems. Our justice system is designed to protect defendants' rights.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, there was a reason for the appellate court to go so far as to overturn the conviction. Okay. But letting him out of prison?
Yeah.
I feel like the evidence they did have should have been substantial enough to keep him in prison while he awaited trial. And maybe that's not how it works. If your conviction's overturned, you're just out. I don't know.
And so when did he get out?
2019.
Wow.
And as you and I sit here today, Tony Tung is out there somewhere, probably taking apart computers, eating Chick-fil-A.
I mean,
scratching his butt crack, doing nothing of importance.
You know, I could see how infuriating. Thank you.
I got you.
Yeah. How mad a person could get being cheated on in a marriage.
Oh, girl, I've been there. Yeah.
I couldn't say
In my marriage, but I'm just saying I have been cheated on in the past, and it's the worst. It's like one of the most violating feelings, and I can't imagine having a family, being married and having children and finding that out.
Right. And wanting to go over to this person's house and demand that it stop, but to take it to another level, like,
you lose everything. Yeah. You lose the very family that you are fearful of losing in the beginning.
But maybe he just thought, I'm losing her anyway, so I have nothing else to lose. Wow.
But
you've got your kids. Yeah.
But, you know, he festered on it for a really long time.
Yeah.
I mean, the affair had been going on for months.
You're right.
And so he
lost festered. Control.
Yeah, he lost control. He absolutely did. But he did this.
He did.
And I just really can't believe that he's out there.
Yeah, because there's no excuse. Yeah.
Sitting in his, you know, probably sunken in love seat that he found on the side of the road with his computer parts sitting everywhere.
So, well, he's awaiting another trial.
Yeah, he'll be retried in May of this year.
So just a month.
Jury selection is supposed to start May 3rd. The prosecution has about 30 witnesses lined up for this trial. I anticipate they will get the same result.
Right.
Knowing what they know now about the technicality, I do think that's an advantage for the state, because now they can carefully present the rest of the evidence that they have without, you know, ruffling that particular set of feathers.
Well, they've had several years to put it all together. So
exactly. Yeah. And hopefully, maybe by this point, they have gathered even more.
Oh, right.
We don't know. So, it's messed up, but we'll keep you guys posted on this case as we know
we'll
more.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it,
Yeah. But rest in peace, Rob, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for telling his story.
I am happy that he lived a very full, fulfilling life.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that he was loved by absolutely everyone, even his ex-wife, who should be the person that really doesn't like you. But if you can get a divorce, an amicable divorce, and your ex-wife still adores the pants off of you. I mean, what does that say about the type of person he was, you know?
Yeah.
So, very sad for his family. Very sad for Sophie. I have so many things to say about her. But, you know, I don't know. It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah.
I do feel bad for her. She entangled herself in a web and, you know, it's tough. But anyhow, this was great. Let's do it again sometime.
All right. We will do that.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.